to this week's Glen Gravity Seminar. We're very pleased to have Sylvain Carrossat visiting us from Marseille, and we will talk about UV completion in a few
minutes. OK, thank you. Thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here, especially inside. And so today I will talk to you about blue field theories and renormalization. And I chose this title to emphasize one aspect of group field theories, which is that asymptotic freedom is possible in this framework. And I would like to show you some of these results and try to ask whether it's physically relevant or not. And so. So it will become clear later if my computer decides to work.
What does it mean in group field theory?
Okay, that's nice. So my computer crashed. I'm sorry.
Really?
Yeah, really. okay.
Uh-oh.
Just a sec. I don't know what to do.
Well, that's not your fault.
No, it's old and tired.
Yeah. Okay. A little technical problem here. Coming back alive.
What's going on? I'm really sorry, it's a very old computer, and
if it crashes again, I can get my own laptop.
Yeah, but then it should be fine. Okay. And okay. So here's the outline of my talk. So I will first recall some background and motivations for the whole approach, the group field theory approach, and for renormalization especially. Then I will focus on one specific example that we start to understand well. But these are toy models, I should emphasize it, which, however, incorporate some of the aspects of what we would need in quantum gravity, namely the gauge invariance condition. And then in this framework, I will show you different UV behaviors you can have in these models, and I will show some examples, and that's the main point of this talk is to show you examples. Okay, so let's start with the background that you probably all know already. So in loop quantum gravity, the main result is a kinematical framework in which to describe quantum geometry. And they are labeled by graphs with additional structures on it, like so, namely SU2 representations, which essentially label the quantum areas, the quantum, areas, and SU2 intertwiners, which are related to volumes. And of course, the main open question in the canonical approach is the dynamics, which is badly controlled and difficult to extract. And that's why spin foams were invented as a way to construct the dynamics in a kind of path integral way by interpolating between these kinematical states with the other types of dynamical structures, which are the spin foams. So basically, the ingredients of spin foams are the kinematical states of loop quantum gravity, labeled by this S here, the spin network states, and some too complex, so some combinatorial structure interpolating between the boundary states. And the output is some amplitude associated so not only to the boundary state, but also to this additional structure, the two complex. So in this sense, it's not complete. It doesn't prescribe a dynamics, because to have a dynamics for QG, you would need just A of S, not A of S and this additional structure C. So once you understand that, there are essentially two ways of going further. So one is to interpret these complexes are as lattices. And so you try to infer the amplitude A of S with some kind of refining or coarse graining procedure. And this is being developed. And the second interpretation is more a QFT one. You interpret each C as some history, specific history, and you invoke the superposition principle to say that you should sum over these. And so that's what group field theories are about. And they try to use the usual quantum field theory formalism to define these sums over amplitudes. Okay, but now a second more physical motivation is the question of the continuum limit of LQG, because the kinematical states that one can control in LQG are very and not very well adapted to the description of continuum limit of continuum effective physics that we are after a priori. So we should understand the continuum limit of these states and of their dynamics. And so this has been, so GFT more recently has been also proposed as a genuine way of looking at the many body sector of loop quantum gravity directly from the canonical, so mainly by Daniele. And in this case, the field, the group field of the field theory is understood as a creation annihilation operator, which creates and annihilates this intertwiner degrees of freedom, these LQG kinematical building blocks. And so if you take this point of view, I don't want to go into the details or not even to particularly promote this view, but it's just that if you take this point of view, then it becomes clear that what the reason why it's important to you to understand the renormalization of these quantum field theories is also very physical. The question is really to understand the phase structure of these theories and to understand where to find the continuum effective physics of GR, for example. Okay. So now let's look into the details very schematically. So usually a GFT is nothing but a field theory for a field phi defined on several copies of a group. So typically the number of copies is the dimension of the space you are trying to recreate, the space-time you are trying to recreate. And the group is a symmetric group. So SU2, SO3-1, depending on the model. And the partition function takes the similar form as in usual field theory. So you have a kinematic term here, quadratic. And then you have interactions specified by this V here, which are particular convolutions of the field. And in particular, they can be local in the group elements here, but non-local in the sense of the whole argument here. So that's the main difference with the local field theories on space-time. And so when we say that we would like to understand the renormalization, these field theories from a renormalization group perspective, here is more or less the outline. It's really just like in usual quantum field theory. So the first thing to do is to try to define a theory space for these field theories. And so in general, what has been done until now is to infer the theory from some underlying spinform models. That is, you start from actually the perturbative expansion in this coupling constants here. And you try to infer what model gives you the specific spin form amplitudes you want to recreate. So this is one ingredient, the spin form model. And the second one is purely combinatorial. So you need to say which, you need to decide which kind of interactions here you allow on a combinatorial basis. And so from these two considerations, usually you get the ingredients of this F integral. So, okay, so, and then comes renormization per se. So once you have a model, you want to show that it is well-defined, because typically, just like in usual quantum field theories, these path integrals are badly defined, and so you need to regulate them with the cutoff here, lambda. And the first task in the program is to show that this model, this partition function, is well-defined in some range of lambda and of the parameters t nu, tv. And typically, this amounts to prove like perturbative renormalizability of the model, but not necessarily. It could be you could also invoke some non-trivial fixed points and show like that the theory is safe or something else. But typically, the simplest thing is to look at perturbative renormalizability. Okay.
Is this regulator lambda? It's a bound on the value.
Yeah, I will give examples later. This was just so it's typically a cutoff on the modes, just like. The final goal is not to stay at this level and have something well defined in some regime that we don't really understand physically. It's really to explore the phase structure of the theory. One, we know it's well defined in some corner of the parameter space, and understand which regime is the one we are after, namely, where can we hope to find classical gravity? Okay. And so let me come back to the title of the talk. So I want to emphasize that the question of whether the theory is UV complete or not is a priori a different one. You could very well achieve all these things without being able to remove the cutoff, if you provide some physical interpretation for it. That's just a remark. And so in view of these three steps, what I will try to do in this talk, so I will try first, I will provide one restrictive set of field theories which define an appropriate theory space, which is stable and a renormalization, and at least in an approximate sense. I will show that in this context, perturbative renormalizability is more or less well understood. And finally, I won't be able to give you many results in the third physical direction, but I will try to show that we are slowly like generalizing the usual field theory methods, which could in principle help us understand the different phases of the theory, and namely, for example, by showing that there are non-trivial fixed points. And along the way, we will see that in the UVs, that is, when you remove the cutoff, you can have various behaviors, and one of them is asymptotic freedom, which means that you don't really have to worry about the interpretation of the cutoff. Okay, so let me first introduce the class of theories I will talk about. So these are at the combinatorial level. So I told you before that there are two ingredients in the models. One comes from quantum gravity per se, from spin forms, and the other one is purely combinatorial. And for now, the criteria we used to define these theories are inspired by tensor models. And there's a natural notion of interaction, which has been proposed as a prescription, if you wish, for the locality of the action, which is based on what is called the tensor invariance. And so you basically require the interaction part of the action to be a sum of so-called connected tensor invariants. And let me now explain briefly what they are. So essentially, they are just tensor invariance is just requiring that the interactions are local in each of the arguments separately of the fields, but not globally. So if you, they are not, so this is not a phi-4 term as in usual field theory, but it is local in each of the arguments separately. And so the way we represent these interactions is as follows. So you take any so-called colored graphs. So here's one example. In a colored graph, you have two types of nodes, black and white, and D types of edges, which are colored. So here you have, this is a three colored graph. And the two rules to construct such a graph are that any black and white, you can only join by an edge nodes which are of different kinds, so black and white. And at any node, you have all the colors, one and only once, hooked to it. Okay, so is this, so let me say a bit more. And the correspondence between this drawing and this interaction term is simply as simple as the following. So to each black node, you associate a phi bar field. So to each white node, you associate a phi field. And then the colors represent convolutions between the argument of the fields. So the color 3 is a convolution between the group element in the third position in the field and another one in the third position in the field. Okay. And so why did people come up with these notions? Actually, it's mainly motivated by the combinatorics and the topology of the forms which are generated in the perturbative expansion of these models. So it's rather independent from the other ingredients which come from spin forms. It's really only topological and combinatorial, not geometrical. So now the second ingredient in these models is of course the notion of scale, because if I talk about renormization, I need some generalization of the usual space-time scale, which is energy, and which is a priori not available in this background independent context. So again, we get inspiration from matrix and tensor models. And we use the size, the kind of abstract size n of a tensor. So this is what is done in tensor models. The dynamical variables there are fields labeled by discrete indices, and these indices range over some finite size, 1 to n. And the UV is defined as large tensors, so with large n, and the infrared is defined as small tensors with small n. So in GFT, we can use the same idea. And instead of, so how does it generalize? So we have fields defined on copies of groups. So on groups, what you have well defined is the notion of mode. So for example, on the group SU2, you can consider this operator, the Laplace-Beltrami operator on the d copies of the group. And then the analog of this n here would be the sum of the j's, essentially the spins associated to this SU2 group. So okay, and in the context of group field theory, this has been suggested already by computation of radiative corrections in some simple models, the Bulatov-Augury models, so by Joseph Benjelloun and Valentin Bonzon a few years ago. So,
there seems to be something backwards from spin-form, and spin-form models small spin is the ultraviolet, the large spin is the infrared.
Well,
what you write is the reverse here.
Yeah, so actually at this stage, I would say that this notion of UV and IR shouldn't be interpreted in a space-time sense, because we don't have a space-time geometry. We don't have a background. So these are purely internal scales, abstract scales.
So in other words, I'm free to transpose and say UV when you say IR and vice versa.
Yeah, if you wish, but also...
Except the normalization group is not a group, it's a semi-group. It only goes one way.
That's exactly why we call it UV and IR, because the renormalization group goes from large spins to small spins. The divergences and the infinite reservoir of degrees of freedom are in the large spins, not in the small ones, from the QFT point of view. And so, but let me mention another point, is that I think, at least from a naive point of view, it's not at all inconsistent with the space-time picture, because from a spin foam perspective, I would tend to think that the continuum physics is to be found in the rather small spins with many building blocks, not large spins per se.
That's true too.
So I would say that this notion of UV IR is kind of I don't know, transplanted, if you wish. I mean, it's not the space-time physics you are talking about yet.
If you think about it, it doesn't make sense at all to integrate all some spins and not integrate all some other spins.
Why?
Because spin is a value. I mean, you could say it's one degree of freedom which you integrate out.
Sure.
So if I would do my core spinning flow, I would not integrate out some spin and then some range, but I would out more complex parts of my network.
I think you can do both. I mean, the other piece of evidence is that the cosmological constant is related to the universe of the level of the quantum deformation.
Mm-hmm.
So that suggests that putting on an infrared cutoff cuts off the device.
Yeah.
Because certainly the cosmological constant is an infrared cutoff.
Yeah. But in this language, I would call it UV cutoff, but it's not, it doesn't matter, it's just a name. But yeah, just because in this context, it could exactly regulate naturally the divergences. So this is something that Aldo has proposed, for example, in a paper last year. And so if you interpret the cosmological constant as some cut off on the spins, then that was part of my conclusion actually of the talk, is that you don't necessarily need to UV complete the theory. You can have really an effective field theory which describes well your model far away from this cutoff given by the cosmological constant, but that's okay. Well,
no, go ahead.
Yeah. So up to now, the things we are able to control are, I think, kind of analogous to the local potential approximation in quantum field theory. That is, we don't have really a good understanding of what is the most general action we can choose, but we know that these kind of actions are stable enough. So we can perform renormalization group analysis of these actions. So they are defined by the interaction part I just talked about, so these tensor invariant interactions, and some additional propagators. So here I put the Laplacian, which gives the scale. But it could be some other derivative operator. So the only subtlety is that in spin foam, the spin foam models typically impose invariances on the fields. So you cannot really write the action like this, because otherwise you would have to integrate over a space of fields which don't support really well-defined Lebesgue measures. So the way these types of models are written usually is like this. So you split the total action into the interaction part and the kinetic part, and you put the kinetic part in the covariance, in the Gaussian measure, defining the kinematics of the theory. So here is something I said already. So the interaction part of the attraction is a sum of tensor invariants. And then the Gaussian measure is made out of two things. So one is the inverse propagator associated to the Laplacian here. And the other thing, which is typically coming from the spin foam understanding of the dynamics of LQG, is a projector here, which projects down on the relevant fields. So the fields which verify the constraints that you want to impose on the theory. Okay. So now let me finish the construction of the type of models I want to talk about. So these are, in addition, gauge invariants. That is, in the projector I talked about, we will just implement one type of constraints coming from spin foam models. But first, let me just flash. So these are all the type of tensorial group field theory models which have been studied so far and proved renormalizable in some sense. And among them, the ones I will talk about today are these two here, which are gauge invariants and interesting toy models, I think. So, and what I will not talk about today is how you prove renormalizability in a rigorous way for these models. So one nice aspect of these models is we can use the multiscale methods to prove in a conceptually clear way that these models are renormalizable at all orders of perturbations. But I don't want to talk about these technical details today. So let me now introduce the last ingredient, which is the gauge invariant condition. So the gauge invariant condition that you infer from spin foam models, and which is there to implement the so-called closure constraint of spin foam models, is a global invariance of the fields. So for any H, any group elements, you can simultaneously translate all the variables, and it should leave the field unchanged. And so if you implement this constraint, as I said before, like with the projector, et cetera, what you get is a propagator, a covariance of this form. So you have two main things here. So one is the Schwinger parameter and the heat kernel here, the three heat kernels here, which are exactly what coming from the inverse Laplace type propagator, as usual in field theory. And the ingredient coming from spin foam models is this additional gauge averaging on this group variable here. And this is what at the level of the amplitudes, this variable here, will introduce a discrete connection on the Feynman graph. So here, I don't want to enter the details, but let me show you this. So the main ingredients in these amplitudes generated by these models are the faces. So they are typically non-local structures on the Feynman graphs. And you have you have to compute the holonomies around these loops and feed them into heat kernels. And so the integrand of the amplitudes are constructed by products of such basic building blocks. But what I want to emphasize is that it's really non-local from the point of view of the graph. So it's not obvious at all that the theory will reproduce itself under coarse graining, if you wish, or under renormalization group, but it is. And so in this class of models, we could classify all the possibly renormalizable models in this class. And the ones which are, I think, most interesting are these two here. So the small d is the dimension of space-time. Big D is the dimension of the group. And Vmax here is the valency of the maximal valency of the renormalizable coupling constants. okay? And you can notice that there is one case which is particularly interesting, is this one in red, because you have the space-time dimension and the dimension of the symmetry group, which match in the sense that here you can choose SU2 for a space-time dimension 3, which is very suggestive of a model for Euclidean quantum gravity in three dimensions. So in particular, I don't want to say that it's a model for Euclidean quantum gravity, because there is this Laplacian, which is not really well understood from this point of view, but at least it provides a very good toy model for loop quantum gravity, I think, because you can work with SU2 spin networks on the boundary, and the things you have to understand are pretty much related to, I guess, LQG. And the second point I want to emphasize here is that it's also very reminiscent of scalar field theories, Euclidean scalar field theories, because you see that in Euclidean scalar field theories, on a dimension 3 space-time, you get a 5-6 renormalizable model, and on a dimension 4 space-time, you get a 5-4 renormalizable model. And here it's really the same, except that the dimension is that of the group, and we have fixed the dimension of space-time to 3. So now I will use these two things here to provide examples of what you can have as a UV behavior. So that is when you try to remove the cutoff, whether the theory makes sense or not. And so let me introduce just two additional, just the setup. So just like in ordinary quantum field theories, you can summarize the renormalizability criterion in some canonical dimension, which is in this context of dimension 3 space-time and defined by this. So for a given interaction B, the dimension is defined as big D, so the dimension of the group, minus D minus 2 NB over 2, where NB is the valency of the interaction. So you see that it decreases with the valency of the interaction, so which is what you want in a renormalizable theory. And then the criteria are as follows. So if the canonical dimension is positive, then the coupling constant is relevant or close to the Gaussian fixed point that is renormalizable. It is marginal when it's zero, and otherwise it is irrelevant, and you can neglect it. Okay, and then I will present the examples in the framework of the effective average action due to Wetterich. And so I guess you already know it, but just to give you a flavor, the idea is to start from a bare action at some cutoff scale lambda, and integrate out all the modes until some infrared scale K, which defines the what is called the effective average action at scale K. And what is without entering the details, this effective average action is defined in such a way that it really interpolates between S gamma when K goes to gamma to lambda, sorry, and the full effective action, gamma zero, when K goes to the infrared. And finally, each of these actions are parameterized by the coupling constant here, TB. And usually it's very convenient to rescale them with the canonical dimension. So here I will work with this U's here, which are rescaled in terms of which have a scaling parameter here with the floating cutoff here. And the question I will be interested about is whether this gamma can be sent to infinity, and what happens to gamma of K when it is still close to the UV. So I will assume this kind of relationship that K is UV in the sense that is way bigger than one, but it's also infrared in the sense that is way smaller than the supposedly fundamental cutoff. And I will do everything perturbative. So the reason why I use the effective average action is just to have this kind of things. It's simpler to analyze the models when you are when you don't have to care about the IR, and also to pave the way for future work, future non-perturbative works. So let me start with the first case when the group dimension is 4. So I remind you, when the group dimension is 4, you have just one coupling constant, which parameterizes the four valent interactions. And one example I can use here is SU2 cross U1, because in the end I want to study the SU2 model. So I just put a U1 factor just to make it four dimensional. And so the mass term here is dimension 2, so I put a k squared term. And so you can compute the flow equations, and it turns out that you get these flow equations. And the thing I want to emphasize here is that you get a minus sign for beta 4, the flow of the marginal coupling constant here. And why do you get that? So it's due to a generic feature of tensorial group field theories, which really arises from this kind of tensorial notion of locality, and which generically produces wave function renormalization at low orders in perturbation, at the first order of perturbation theory. So that's why this strong wave function renormalization, unlike what happens in usual scalar field theories, can balance the vertex renormalization terms and create a minus one here. So as a result, this model in four dimension is asymptotically free. So you have a scale and some low energy scale, gamma zero, which is dynamically generated by the flow here. And the marginal coupling constant converges to zero in the UV. So in this sense, this model is one example, clear-cut example, in which you see that GFTs can be UV completed in a natural way, unlike their scalar field theory cousins.
So does it mean, so at high spin, I don't have this interaction term which gives me tetrahedral?
So
this interaction term means tetrahedral.
Yeah.
So you say basically this becomes zero.
Yeah, but it's not where you want to compute things. You want to compute things at low spins, in principle.
Wherever you want to compute things.
Yeah.
That's I ask you later about where you want to compute things. But it means that you lose completely your manifold properties because you lose this term which moves.
Yes, but again, the full effective action contains also the low energy things where you have these. To me, the way I interpret it is just that you don't have to care about the interpretation of this cutoff, because it doesn't spoil the convergence of the theory. There is no, you can consider the theory defined at any cutoff scale. So it doesn't mean that the theory is trivial in the same sense that the scalar field theory, which is a field theory which is asymptotically free, is not trivial. No. It's just that it's well behaved in the UV. And so whether it is an effective theory or not, you don't really, it doesn't really matter because it's well defined. Or I don't know. But it doesn't mean that the theory is trivial, no? I mean.
No, I was asking more than geometric interpretation, but
but it means that when you get.
If I take this UV,
it means that if you want to make huge tetrahedra interact, they don't, if you wish.
There.
So, but to me, it's not shocking, you know. I mean, it's just I don't have any I'm completely agnostic about how huge the train run should interact.
But it's, I mean, the kinetic term is a gluing term.
Yeah.
This term is actually the term which forms the
triangle. Ah, yeah, sorry. Yeah. So the triangles, they still interact, but they don't form,
they don't form the triangle.
Bound. They don't form molecules. Oh, I don't know. I mean, yes.
The rank?
Yeah, the rank,
because you are taking a larger
n. You mean the n?
Yeah.
So the n in group field theory is just a cutoff to make the theory well defined. In principle, you just sum over all the over n. It's just the analog of a momentum cutoff, if you want. So you just expand the field theories. It can be expanded in a representation. So in the case of SU2, in terms of the spins, and to make things converge, you just cut off this, and this is what is called, what is the analog of the N in tensor models. So.
But in tensor model, the N is the rank of the
tensor. No, it's the number of is the space in which the indices vary. So it's just the indices vary from 1 to N. The rank is what I call D, and is the space-time dimension, if you wish. Should I continue? So then, the second thing you can look at, in analogy with usual field theories, is a perturbation of the dimension of the group around four dimensions. So how is it done here? That's why I included actually a U1 factor and not in the previous case. So you can just analytically continue the dimension of the U1 factor. So you consider a group of dimension D like this, and then you analytically continue this D, and this procedure is well defined. It's just a way to understand the qualitative properties of these field theories. It's not physical, okay? So in this case, what changes with respect to the previous case is that the four-valent coupling acquires a small canonical dimension. And as a result, when you compute the beta function, you get a new term here proportional to the dimension. And so just like in usual field theories on dimension 4 minus epsilon spacetimes, you find a non-trivial fixed point, which is in the perturbative region when epsilon is small enough, and which is as follows. And let me show you like the qualitative shape of the phase portrait. So the difference with the usual Wilson-Fisher situation in space-time in scalar field theories is that the signs of the coupling constants at the fixed point are reversed. So in the Wilson-Fisher case, the fixed point is here rather than here. Okay, but otherwise it's the same. You will have just one relevant direction for the non-Gaussian fixed point here, and like the two directions you have for the Gaussian fixed point here. Okay, and on this drawing, the arrows like point towards the IR, towards low cutoffs. So it's just an example of a non-trivial fixed point. Is it okay? Yeah.
Does it mean you get an unstable potential in the
Yeah, sure. So the sign is really the wrong sign, if you wish. But I'm not trying to. So the reason I talk about it is not because I'm trying to use this fixed point physically, but I'm trying to understand whether it can potentially survive in the when epsilon goes to 1, and there you can control the convergence with the phi 6 terms, which could possibly be positive. So in this case, I agree it doesn't make sense, but it's more. So here's the not the closest to physical situation is the SU2 case, so epsilon to 1. And in this case, you get two additional coupling constants of order 6 here. I don't represent the exact way you should convolute the fields here, but it doesn't really matter. And the phi 4 term becomes of dimension 1. And so you can again compute the beta functions at one loop. For example, here's the lowest truncation, and you get something like this. And here, the fact that you get only minus signs, by the way, here, is also again due to the strong wave function renormalization. And so to determine, to understand whether this theory is asymptotically free or not, just like the four-dimensional model, you should study the at the very least, like this three-dimensional flow, beta 4, beta 6, 1, and 6, 2.
Which space
time dimension is that? So 3. So it's 3 space time dimension and SU2 group. And so here the qualitative, so it's a bit tricky to understand the qualitative structure of the phase portrait because it's three-dimensional, but you can look at the invariant subspaces defined by U61 and U62 equals 0. So for example, U62 equals 0 here. And the qualitative structure is as follows. So you have trajectories which stay on the U4 axis so that you cannot cross this line here. So when you are in one of the half planes here, you stay there. And the interesting physical case, U6 positive, so to ensure convergence, you see that though you can get arbitrarily close to the Gaussian fixed point, you are, so this is the error, this is the UV, you are always repelled to it in the deep UV. And so it's not, so this theory is not well behaved in the UV at the perturbative level. So this means that you cannot exclude the existence of a Landau pole. And so formally you can see that it's only on the wrong side of the phase space that you can have asymptotic freedom here, and you always have it. But okay, so this was in the 2D plane, but you can see more generally that if you want both U61 and U62 positive, you cannot have asymptotically asymptotically free model. Okay, but now the question I would like to ask, I mean, I won't answer it, I don't know, but the question I would like to ask next is, can we use the qualitative understanding we had in dimension 4 minus epsilon to say, oh, but maybe there is a non-trivial fixed point here, which could make these trajectories safe and not, if not asymptotically free, they could be asymptotically safe. So, okay. So I'm basically done, so let me summarize. So my goal was to explain to you that we have a partial understanding of what, of how group field theory should be understood from a renormalization group perspective, and this is thanks to a specific class called tensorial group field theories. There we understand well perturbative renormalizability. We can classify all the models which are renormalizable or not. And this is already some progress towards 4D quantum gravity because we know how to work with the SU2 group and how to implement a closure constraint, but it's there is a long way to 4D gravity. And one interesting aspect is that you can naturally get asymptotic freedom. So that is, you can have well-defined group field theories at all scales at a perturbative level already. And then I think it's also, I suggested that it might also be some asymptotically safe behavior for a phi 6 model on a group SU2. And so what can we do next? So one thing I think is really important is to try to develop more practical tools. So for example, functional renormalization group equations So this has already been developed by Astrid, Tim, and more recently, Dario, Joseph, and Daniele. Here's, for example, a drawing I took from this paper, where they studied the U1 cube model, but without gauge invariant constraint, without gauge invariance. And they could show that it seems that there is indeed a Gaussian fixed point, but also a non-Gaussian one here, which has similar properties as what I described in dimension from an S epsilon. And so the natural next step, I think, is to do the same for this SU2 model or U1 cube, if you wish, but with gauge invariance condition. And because, as we've seen, it's a natural playground because we already suspect that there might be a non-trivial fixed point there. So it's a natural avenue to test the thing. And then, of course, the things to do is to go towards 4D quantum gravity. So one pedestrian way of doing it is to try to implement step by step, so the simplicity constraints into this already existing framework, the Lorentzian signature, et cetera, et cetera. So it can be done probably, but it's going to be more involved for sure. And if we do that, it would be nice also to understand now that we see that we can have field theories which are UV complete, but we should ask ourselves, is it necessary? And so if we construct a randomizable 4D quantum gravity model which is not UV complete, should we have to worry? And well, maybe not, because of this interpretation of the cosmological constant, for example, proposed by Aldo, which could be related to this effective cutoff we put on this model. So you would not need necessarily to have UV completion of the theory. And okay, more generally, I think that, so this is all nice, but I think one thing which is desperately missing in GFT, I think, is the clear relation with loop quantum gravity, in the sense that we would like to understand what is really the theory space of 4D quantum gravity in a GFT picture. And this is clearly missing, because at this stage we have like kind of constructions which are a bit unbalanced. So we take something from spin foams, something from tensor models, and we show that, oh, it's consistent, but we don't show that it's the way to go. So it would be very, very nice, but probably very difficult to get also, to have a symmetry principle which defines once and for all the theory space of GFTs. And then randomization group methods would be very, very interesting, because they would be interesting if we get positive answers, but also if we get negative answers, we could say, okay, this doesn't work, we should move to something else. But at this stage, it's a bit difficult, because if we try to construct a 4D quantum gravity model just by implementing the simplicity constraints into what we already know how to do, if it doesn't work, what will we conclude? Like, is it the spin foam model which is bad, or is it the combinatorial restrictions we imposed on the GFT which are bad, or the whole approach? I mean, it's a bit difficult. So if we have a clear symmetry principle from first principles, this would change it, but of course it's a difficult task. So, and okay, I finished just to say that the references I used are this paper with Daniele and Vincent, and then these two papers, with this one supposed to appear today at 8 p.m. But so I don't know the number. And thank you for your attention. I think it's the same issue. So you can say that each amplitude, apart from this Laplace term, which is a bit unclear, you can say that each amplitude generated by the models I studied here are really discrete histories of Euclidean quantum gravity, but on specific on specific discrete structures. So there is no, I think what is lacking is really a connection between the geometric understanding, I mean the constraints you impose, and the combinatorial structure, the structure of the complex, which is completely arbitrary at this stage. So you can choose whatever. The only constraint we have is that it should be stable under constraining, but it's not unique a priori. So. Sure. But the other question is that the whole GFT business, I think, is not very natural in 3D because you have something which is a topological invariant a priori. So it makes more sense to say, okay, I stick to one discretization and that's it. I don't have to sum anything. Yes.
It's more of just an annoying question.
This one?
To this initial discussion we had, so if I just take loop quantum gravity, for instance, or spin foams, then you know many people speak of spins as kind of observer,
mm-hmm.
which is already not well defined there.
Yeah.
So spin is not an observer. I mean, if you try to make sense of all of it, it's
yeah.
an expectation value. That even doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
In this sense, it makes more sense. It makes even more sense in good field theory. In the first, if you really took good two spin forms, you would actually not be able to integrate out high spins. For me, it doesn't make sense because it would be like integrating out some field value 5 from 5 to 6, and that is for me that makes sense. And good field theory, you can do that because you discuss a field theory exactly on the space of spins or on the hook. But then again, the relation between observables and gravity and observables and good field theory is something which is not very often discussed.
No, agree.
And I think the observables in good field theory is something which is kind of quite unclear to me. So maybe you can comment more on for instance, what are observables in good field theories and what kind of things you would actually expect. I mean, if you do renormalization, you want to have some stable behavior of some kind of observables at maybe low momenta or whatever you expect.
Yeah, so I think the key assumption here is that even if we don't know what are the dynamically relevant observables for the effective continuum physics, we can maybe assume that they can be picked on low spins in a sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So that from a field theory perspective, it makes sense because you just want to compute like low energy physics, so to speak, and so you can.
Yeah, so basically I can probably ask gravity, I know Dirac observables are observables of a theory.
If I
take GFT as a field theory, okay, it seems to be the field is my observer.
Yeah.
What does it mean in physical terms, in terms of measurement? Okay, I have this field operator, what do I observe? How do I measure phi of G? Phi of K.
Yeah, but I mean,
how do it translate to something which I measure in the real world?
But in the real world, I cannot say. But for any observable a priori, for any observable you have in loop quantum gravity, you can construct the GFT equivalent.
Of course, say it again.
So for any observable you have in loop quantum gravity, you can construct the a priori the second quantized equivalent, if you wish.
So for any kinematical observer in LQG?
Yeah, I would say so.
Construct an observer which is...
The second quantized version of it, if you wish.
Which is still an observer.
But
so in this sense...
In the sense of field theory, not in the sense...
But then I get much more observers than LQG.
Maybe.
Any kind of kinematical observer.
What do you mean? Sorry.
If you say anything, I mean, I make a difference.
Yeah, but in LQG, well.
Kinematical and physical observers.
Yeah. But in LQG, it's already a huge issue, no, to study observables. It's already a huge issue, a very difficult issue at the canonical level. And I don't think GFT can bring anything new from this point of view. It just relies on the canonical.
That's not what I'm claiming. I'm saying I understand to a certain level what are observables in LQG or in gravity, understood as gravity. If the metric is my field.
Mm-hmm.
And in group field theory, I understand basically as a field theory on a group.
Yes.
And naively accept this projection symmetry, which you impose sometimes. All kinds of field observables are observables of this theory.
Yeah, sure.
And so
but
I'm
then,
just asking about the interpretation,
but then,
some possible interpretation of all these observables.
Yes.
But
I think there is a clear correspondence between kinematical observables and then and observables in the field theory sense. But then, if you ask about the physical observables, I would assume that they would just be zero, like in the field theory context. You can define them, but you get zero. No, not the non-physical ones, sorry. The ones that are not invariant under the symmetries. They just average out, I would say. But I don't know, I haven't studied all this in detail, so I cannot. But just to be clear, the point.
You can have it in usual field theory, right?
What?
You can have it in usual field theory. So in usual field theory, what you do is that you compute correlators. And then these are not the observables. The observables are just the S-metrics, right? And so you start from the correlators. The correlators are not on-shell. That's the Feynman descriptions. We don't, because they contain all the virtual processes, they contain sums of the topology.
Yeah.
So that's this, physically you have the same thing. The observables are related to limits of correlators, which are the S-metrics. Here, in
so,
GFT.
So then if I get all S matrices, I can translate them, they have some meaning. And
usually.
Also terms in LQG, which correspond to physical observables, that's the thing.
Yes, of course, that's the usual. The challenge in GFT is to go from correlators to S matrix elements, and there's no prescription.
Yeah.
So the correlators are all off-shed. So it's not going to happen what you're saying. If you compute things in GFT, this was proven a long time ago, that even if the operator are in the kernel of the Hamilton constraints, the GFT expectation value will not be zero.
Mm-hmm.
Because the GFT contains some of all possible topology.
Yeah.
Whereas the LQG will restrict one topology. Right?
It's also not very clear what
S-matrix
means, if you don't have any asymptotic.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So
that's,
in GFT,
yeah, but that's
you have a notion of correlation, but you don't have a notion of unshellness, right?
Mm-hmm.
This notion, this extra procedure to extract observables, which are S-matrix.
But the lack of asymptotic states, I guess, it's the same in the canonical picture. No, you don't know what is the. There is no clear separation between kinematics and dynamics.
I disagree because in the canonical picture, you can at least say, okay, I put asymptotic boundary conditions in that way. And GFT is, I mean, if you are really
you could
group manifold, what is your asymptotic region?
No, but the asymptotic region you would describe in terms of the observable you put in the, you compute in the field theory. You would construct a boundary state, which is a superposition of canonical boundary states, if you wish, which are picked on some geometry, asymptotic geometry, and then.
But it's a boundary state in your group manifold, no? It's not boundary in the space time.
But so the field is The field theory describes a discrete building block for the field for boundary states. So if you convolute fields, you can construct arbitrary boundary states. And that's what described the kinematics, the asymptotic region of your spacetime, but we don't know how to construct it. But in principle, I don't see any difference with the canonical picture.
No, I'm really okay. I'm just saying, if I just say this is a field theory, it's a field theory on a group manifold.
Yeah.
If I just take standard field theory and think in Boxley, I can go to T minus infinity and T plus infinity,
yeah,
and that defines me an S matrix.
Yeah.
My group manifold, I don't know what is T going to be, T minus infinity and T plus infinity.
Sure.
So
yeah.
It's for me, a priori, physically, it can be unclear what.
But the key difference, I guess, with the usual field theory is we are not interested at all in the scattering regime.
I think the discussion to frame it is that in both cases, you're right, there's a similarity. In both cases, you have states which are labeled by spin networks, and then you compute amplitudes. Now, the amplitudes you hope to get in FQG, and the amplitudes you get in GFT are of different nature. So the difference is that in FQG, the amplitudes you're computing, they should be positive semi-definite, right? They have a kernel, and this kernel, hopefully, is the kernel of the Hamilton constraint. So that's what Bianca is talking about.
Yeah.
Now in GFT, if you compute just a correlation, you don't have a kernel. So that's true in field theory. If you compute amplitude at finite points, and you don't take the LZK extraction of it, then you don't project out onto physical states, the solutions of the Hamiltonian constraints.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tension. So in GFT,
you
can put these correlators and maybe get some continuum limit, but you cannot, and it's a continuum limit of the correlator, the full correlator that contains all possible virtual processes.
So I agree.
But the challenge here is to, can you extract? So in some sense, it's easier to get the continuum in GFT, right?
Mm-hmm.
But once you have it, it's very hard to extract, let's say, the analogous of the S matrix. So when you say you're not interested into the scattering, so be careful, the scattering.
I meant with few, fields.
No, but here, it's not that. It's the scattering is, in the sense, projection onto physical space.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the S matrix is. Gives you the projector. And so in usual GFT, that's the tension. In one hand, it's easy to take the continuum limit. In the other hand, you can define.
But that's also why I think that we should maybe take a step back and try to strengthen the link between the canonical framework and the GFT. And that's why I think that what Daniele proposed recently is interesting, even if it's not completely clear. And but clearly the renormalization business, it does not address this question. What is the clear relation between the canonical picture and the GFT? The renormalization business is the tool to, once you have this clear, the tool to extract the physics in an efficient way. So physics.
Except you don't know what the physics is.
Yeah, but do you know what the physics is in loop quantum gravity?
GFTs, I guess, right?
What?
Yeah, I think it's.
So it's a more general problem. I think we have to grill on GFTs here for this. Okay, any other questions? Last question.
In your analysis of the 3D SU2 models, what kind of property in the renormalization reflects the fact that the theory doesn't have local degree?
So it's a toy model, so there is. There's this Laplacian, so it's unclear. I don't know how to answer your question, but I mean, we don't have. These amplitudes are not invariant under change of discretization. So no, but the reason is that this is a toy model for the 4D case where we don't expect. That's why we don't we don't take it seriously as far as 3D gravity is concerned.
But it's related to the previous discussion, so
okay.
I think, you know, it's worth studying in 3D to try to understand the physics there.
Okay.
In 3D, what happens is that your amplitude is so between two spin networks will be positive definite.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there will be no kernel. And you can argue that this means that you're summing in some way over all possible genus. You know,
yeah.
You compute two, you put two dimensional spheres, and then there's all possible three-dimensional genus manifold in between. But that's really what the amplitude is. You know, if you could have a procedure to extract, like if there was an S matrix prescription, then you would project out the physical state, and then you would see that, that there's only a finite number.
Yeah.
So it is related. Like the fact that in 4D, this procedure will leave you lots of state, but in 3D, you know, it will just project out.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, I have to think about it.
All right. Then let's thank Sylvain again.